caffeinated and attention. So we're going to be looking at space-time diagrams. So where I want to get to by the end of today, the next hour, is everyone kind of having a feel for them and basically having the tools in place, because it'll take a little bit more work. But once you get space-time diagrams in place, in particular space-time diagrams for different observers, different reference frames, then, as I was saying, pretty much you can get a pictorial, graphical understanding of twin paradox, you see, just comes out. And also the time dilation of length contraction, relativity of simultaneity, and a lot of other things. It's a very, very useful tool. They're fantastic. So we're kind of looking at, so we've got space and time. So we could have two points here. We want to find out the distance between them. And use the Pythagorean theorem. And in the same sense, we've got two points here in space and time. And we want to get the analogous thing. And people call that, instead of just the space-time distance, the distance of time and space, sometimes talk about as the interval. So it's basically the same thing. It's the analogous thing. It's some sort of measure of the distance or the variation between these two points that is independent of all observers. All observers measure to be the same. Because that's what a good concept of distance does, like I was saying. But the distance between Toronto Waterloo does not depend on how you think relative to it. So that's actually what you've got. And so it turns out that if you actually use this concept of the interval, if you like, between two points in space and time, then every observer, no matter what their motion is relative to those two points, no matter what their reference frame, whether they're going at 99% the speed of light relative to those two points, or reference frame where those two points are stationary, or whatever the situation is, everyone measures that to be the same. It's invariant, if you like. And so it's got this nice property we want to measure of distance or interval to have. And it's got this kind of weird minus sign. So it's got something squared and something else squared, but it's a minus sign. So mathematically, that's again, where I said a lot of the weirdness, the special relativity comes in. So hopefully that seems reasonable. And so what actually does it mean, this difference in the minus sign that we've motivated? So you might have expected that, but as I said, that doesn't work. You start using that x squared plus time squared, or maybe you might want to make that units of distance and change time to units of distance and multiply it by speed. But again, that would mean if you use that, then it would be like we would measure the distance between here and here to be one value and different observers another value in space and time. So we would be incompatible. We wouldn't be talking the same language. And so what that means, as I said, that it's space and time. This minus sign means space and time are connected in a very, very strange manner. So what that means is space and time is not Pythagorean or Euclidean. And so that this Pythagoras' law does not hold. But in space and time, a squared plus b squared is not equal to c squared in this sense that we're talking about here. And what are the implications? So one way of looking at it is, so imagine we have the kind of, you might have seen this map of the Earth, and it's called, got a technical name, it's projection. So you're trying to represent the surface of the Earth on a two-dimensional page. It's difficult. So you have various projections. This is one of them, it's called the flat car projection. And if you look at that, you have to be a bit careful how you interpret that. So if you look at it naively, you might think, well, Antarctica is this big line that kind of stretches out down the bottom of the Earth. But no, you know, it's not. It's actually, well, it's roughly kind of circular with sort of spiky edges. But the way we just represent it is this big, long, stretched out thing. So there's some distortion in the representation. And also the points A and B, if you look at them naively, you can measure the distance between them. It looks like they're some distance apart. But they're actually right at the top. And so all of the points along here right at the top actually are the North Pole. They're the same point. So even though they're separated on this representation or this projection of the surface of the Earth, there's actually zero distance between A and B. It's just, in a sense, we've got a distorted representation or representation which doesn't really mimic all the full situation. And so we can't naively just get out of or measure the distance between A and B on our representation, this diagram or projection, and say, yep, the distance between that is those points is 100 kilometers or 1,000 kilometers or whatever we choose.
Yeah, but can I throw something in here? Just a good chance to throw in some SKSD stuff too, like the social stuff. I do a quick little lesson on the bias introduced by different distortions.
Yep.
And the bias is the one we use in most atlases is European based.
Right.
Whereas if you did it by land mass, Africa's huge,
yeah,
and Europe's tiny. Yeah. So it's just something you can throw in there as well, if you can actually talk a little bit about different maps and why would we use certain comparisons.
Yep, excellent point. And so just as we have that example in for that projection, you can't just, with space time growing up, you have to be careful, you can't just have points A and B, you can't just get out of ruler or a tape measure, measure out what the distance between those two points is, and say, yeah, that's what the distance between them is in space-time, or to use slightly more technical language, that's what the interval is between them. You can't, just for this, exactly the same reason why you can't do that in this case. The representation you have, or the projection of the underlying space and time, or in this case space, just cannot be naively interpreted. We've got some distortions or in the representation. And the reason we do is we're just trying our best to represent this unusual thing in as sort of tangible and easy way as possible. So that's sort of one caveat to be aware of. So what is space and time like? So if we have normal XY plane with normal Euclidean space of a two-dimensional surface of a table, for example, then we have this concept of distance of any point from the origin is given by d equals the square root of x squared plus y squared, standard thing. And what we could draw circles to find the locus of all points that are a constant distance away from the origin. So all the points that are 1 unit away from the origin, circle radius 1, 2 units, radius 2, etc., etc. And so what we've built up is these points are kind of, in a sense, contour lines, the constant distance away. And so if we want to do the analogous thing in space and time, we actually get something kind of interesting. So if we do the analogous thing for space-time, we have this kind of different structure to the distance. And what we actually find is we have the analogous thing here is replaced by this, and I guess I've just squared that, make that d squared, x squared plus y squared. Remember, this is the metric or the sort of interval or the distance equation that we had. And if you look at that, that's in a sense like y squared minus, or x squared minus y squared equals some constant a. And so if you're just looking at an equation x squared minus y squared equals a, where a is a constant x and y variable, then that's the equation for an hyperbola. And so that's exactly what we have there. So c, for time, and x are the variables. We have s, which depends on how c and t, x and t. And so if we actually plot all the points that have the same s value, or the same space-time interval, away from the origin, then s space-time interval of 1, then it's all the points along this curve here, which is a hyperbola, it's sort of the asymptotes there. And these are lines of slope 1 and minus 1 there. But also we've got the negative solutions, we've got the square. So it's all these points here have an s value of 1 and an s value of 2, all these points here and below. And then the third one, the one above, and the one right down the bottom there, these curves, these hyperbola. And so this is, in a sense, just as this is giving you a handle of the structure of normal two-dimensional surfaces, x and y planes, this picture, this plot, on the space-time diagram, is kind of giving you a handle on really the essential structure of space and time.
CT is in brackets, whole square.
Oh, yes, actually, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for that. And so really what we can see just with this difference is, again, this is just telling us at a qualitative level, there's just something strange with space and time and the way they're connected in special relativity, and that makes sense, because there's got to be something strange about space and time for us to get things like time dilation, for us to get length contraction, and for life to actually behave in the strange way it does with a strange relative motion of velocity. So that's maybe some kind of roughly qualitative argument why you might expect things to be different in space and time, and actually how they're different is driven by sort of this exact formula here. So space-time is actually based on a hyperbola, not circles. And so what we have instead of Euclidean or normal Cartesian space, it's actually it's after Lorentz. So it's called Lorentz space. So this is what we have in spatial relativity. And so just a little plug, we have the Meet the Researcher session, and so that will be from 12 to 1 today. And today scientists so we're meeting a number of researchers from the institute, and today scientists so that's one strange idea about space and time, and today scientists have even more unusual ideas about space and time. And just very quickly, if you go to string theory, the superstring theory, which is one of the theories around today, that only says space and time are actually defined down to what's called the Planck scale. In particular, the Planck scale of Planck's length is the smallest possible length that space is defined down to. That's incredibly, incredibly tiny, 10 to the minus 35 meters. And that's the smallest possible distance you can have in string theory. And that kind of constraint in there is put in, that because that's a theory that tries to combine general relativity and quantum physics together all in one unified theory, just as Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism. So string theory, they're trying to unify the two great achievements of 20th century physics, quantum theory and general relativity, the theory of gravity on the other hand. And so to actually get everything working, stop the theory from just making nonsensical predictions and lining up, they actually kind of limit or sort of quantize space in the sense that they can't get lengths any more fundamental than that. And so we'll have some string theorists at lunch if you have any more detailed questions to ask. Another thing is that string theory says that there are actually 9 dimensions of space instead of the normal 3, x, y, and z. But the reason, so that's another very strange thing that it says. Another alternative theory that a number of people here are pursuing is loop quantum gravity. And again, that also says that space is fundamentally grainy or discrete or quantized at the level. So this is a level far, far below even the atomic level, even below the nuclear level. You're talking about 20 orders of magnitude below, smaller than nuclear level. So it's not something you can get anywhere near probing experimental. It's not something we can get near seeing in even the most powerful particle accelerator. But this is what the theories have. And that is the smallest possible area, which is 10 to the minus 66 meters cubed, and as small as possible volume, which is 10 to the minus 99 meters cubed. And so they're phenomenally tiny. I mean, I think in that volume, you can fit more grains of sand in that volume than there are atoms in the entire universe. It's phenomenally tiny. But so again, for more information, more details, we'll have people from both of those theories at lunch. Okay, so let's looking at things from different perspectives. So far, we've just looked at one reference frame or one perspective, but you want to switch between the two. And you do this in showing physics, looking at things from the lab reference frame, looking at things from the perspective of a ball or a particle moving at 10 meters per second relative to the lab, or a car moving at 15 kilometers per hour relative to the laboratory or some tree or the ground or something like that. And so in Galilean relativity, in Newtonian mechanics, the transformation rules are quite simple. If you have someone moving at a constant velocity plus v relative to some reference frame, then what you do their reference frame for the person moving is just a reference frame that actually moves kind of along like this. So the x-axis coincide. Again, we just have one dimension of space, so it's very, very simple. We're just looking at distance in the line. And just obviously, as we go in time, this reference frame moves further and further over, because the origin of that is actually moving and coinciding with the ball or the car or the person walking, whatever that is. So that's transformations that we get transforming between one reference frame to another in Galilean relativity or Newtonian mechanics. And the basic thing is that, distances change, and just get very simple distance transformation laws that if a person in this reference frame measures some event to be happening at position X, the person moving at velocity v relative to them will not measure it to happen at position X, but at position X, which is X minus vt. So we just have the transformation that as they move along, their distance or x-axis, like scales, get more and more out of sync with each other. So that's a very simple transformation law there, which underlies this change between coordinates. So we get exactly the same thing, changing between reference frames and special relativity, but as you might expect, it's a little bit strange. But pretty much once we get this, then we're done. We've got space-time diagrams in place, and you'll see we're able to get, again, equatorial representations of length contraction and time dilation. So let's imagine we have a spaceship moving at the constant velocity of half c, 0.5 c the speed of light, past Earth. So what does its world light look like? So what is all the sequence or the series of points that describe where it is at particular points in time? So we saw it's basically like the space-time diagram you do for the car, or the athlete running a 100-meter race in the Olympics. But, of course, the person will be moving at, obviously, the spaceship will be moving at considerably faster than an athlete. And so in that case, what we do is at half the speed of light. So it's actually so a world line of someone moving at no speed is vertical, and someone moving at a small speed is just away from vertical, so a very, very, very steep gradient. And as the speed increases, what the person is doing is actually moving for each step up in time, they move further in space because they're traveling at a greater velocity. So basically, we want to tilt it further over that way. So light, in this case, light traveling away is at a 45-degree angle because for every unit up in CT, it actually moves across one unit in space. And so light, kind of a line of light, so a laser beam shining out is at a 45-degree angle. That's the speed it travels at. Nothing can travel fast for speed of light. So everything, basically every word line thing moving at constant velocity will have, be somewhere here, have a gradient greater than 1, greater than 45 degrees. And so that's probably roughly around about right, so world line for the spaceship. And so let's look at things from the spaceship's perspective. From the spaceship's perspective, you know, the Klingon in the spaceship, they're thinking, well, I'm just standing still, I'm stationary in my reference frame, it's to say the Earth is moving away from me, or moving past me at a constant velocity. And so I'm always at my origin all the time. So I'm at x dash equals zero. We'll call the Klingon's reference frame by dashes, so x dash equals zero the whole time. And so I'm not moving, and so all the points that the Klingon is on, so if we think of how we define, say, the time axis or the CT axis for the Earth's frame, well, that's given by all the points, just the equation, x equals zero. So this vertical line is given by x equals zero, and that's someone, again, someone on Earth is thinking at every single time I'm at my own origin, I'd have to move with respect to myself. So at time zero, I'm x equals zero. I'm not stationary moving back to the Earth frame, so moving ahead in time, I'm again at x equals zero, x equals zero, x equals zero. So that means that all the points or the set of events of the person in some particular reference frame, then they just add up or define the t-axis or the ct-axis. So just as we've done that there, there's nothing special about Earth's reference frame. As we said, remember the relativity postulate, the laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frame. So it's just as valid for the Klingon to think, well, I'm the one that's stationary, it's the Earth that's moving past me at half the speed of light. And so from the Earth's reference frame, you can do exactly that. You can get all the sequence of points where you are, and they define your CT axis or your time axis, because you're not moving relative to yourself, so all of those points have x equals zero. So the Klingon spaceship can do the same thing. So all of these points here correspond to x equals, or x dash equals zero, because they're zero distance away from where the Klingon is. They coincide with the Klingon in the spaceship. And so what that means is that just as in from Earth's perspectives, the line x equals zero defines this axis, nothing special about Earth's axis, so the line x dash equals 0 defines the time axis for the Klingon, or the CT dash axis, if you like. And so we found out that's the Borg line there. And so that actually is the CT axis, or the time axis, basically, for the Klingon in the spaceship, or anything moving relative to Earth at half the speed of light. So it's kind of strange. So here we had it's just a straight line, so the time axis was the same. It coincided in the previous case, but this is special relativity. We have a different structure to space and time, and we've just found out that this is actually the time axis for the Klingon. So this is actually how we have transformed into a different reference frame. What we want to find is where the two axes are, so we have one of the two axes. So that's fine there. So we've got this situation here.
Okay. A quick question.
Yeah.
The Earth often looks to go both spectral. Well, actually, it goes on this, what, more or less what you're saying.
Yeah.
But of course, the Earth is spinning.
Right.
And is the acceleration due to the Earth moving around the sun, or the Earth's own rotation, considered insignificant?
So what do you...
So the Earth is not entirely in an inertial reference frame. Because the Earth is going in a circle on its own axis.
Yeah.
And then the Earth is going around the sun and so forth.
Right.
So is that acceleration considered negligible, or how does that fit in here?
Right, yeah, so you don't, for the scales...
We seem to ignore that, and we say we're in an inertial reference frame.
Sure. So for the kind of the scales and the problems that we're looking at, that doesn't take into account. You don't need to take that into account.
So is it considered insignificant? Is that the reason? I know we don't take it into account.
Right, so I mean, Newton's laws of motion hold. I mean, the operational definition of an inertial reference frame is where the Newton's laws of motion hold, and that they hold in our reference frame. And so that is, I mean, that's an inertial reference frame from that definition. So we can actually use it. So in that sense, that acceleration. Around the center of the galaxy or whatever, doesn't impact whether we have an inertial reference frame or not. We can use Newton's first law as well, so it is an inertial reference frame. But again, I mean, they're actually very, very subtle questions here. But
with justification,
So we have so that's the time axis we have there. So what we need to find, we've got halfway, we need to find one more axis. So it's kind of, to me, it's very, very strange that it's going at a diagonal line like this. I mean, why isn't it just the same case that we have here? Well, it's really due to the strange structure of space and time, but this is what the argument tells us. So we want to find the time axis. And so it's a little bit involved, but what about the space axis, the x-axis axis, for the Klingon in the spaceship moving at 50% speed of light? And so what we have is, here in this reference frame, what defines the x-axis? Well, the x-axis, that's just the line CT equals 0. It's the horizontal line like this. So what we want to find, so an analogy with that, to see the x-axis defined by the line T dash equals 0. So if we can find all the points where T dash equals 0, where the Klingon will register or say, that, yes, that is time 0, then we just draw a line between all those two points. We find out what the x-axis is. Because imagine we didn't know what the x-axis is. We just knew what time was. On this axis, what we could find is we just get all the points where time is 0. We would have this whole line of points along here. Just draw a line between them. We join them together. Then we have the x-axis. So what we're going to do is exactly the same sort of procedure now for the... x-axis axis to find that the Klingon in the spaceship. So let's determine by the following procedure, and we'll do this together. So consider, so we have the spaceship with the Klingon. So let's say the commander of that turns on a high-power flashlight at some time in the past. So that's a negative time, an example of a negative time. So their time is measured by T dash. And so sometime in the past, let's call it minus capital T, they just turn on a flashlight. You can see there that goes out in space towards some mirror. And then the script reflects back, and say it comes back time capital T, so plus capital T. And so this light travels, takes the same distance to go out to the mirror as it does get to go back. And so what that means is where it will reach the mirror will be time zero for the Klingon in the spaceship. So time minus T there, zero there, and then plus capital T going back. And so if we actually find all the points where, if we actually find the point where the light actually hits the mirror and actually get that as a point on the space-time diagram, then that will actually be a point where T dash equals zero. That will actually be a point on the time axis, or it's actually, so actually on the space axis, the X dash axis for the Klingon. So with the strange one thing about light, we actually know that light, no matter what source of it is, everyone measures it to be going at c, the speed of light, 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. And so that means even though the Klingon actually emits the light, the person on Earth will see it traveling at the speed of light. And if something is traveling at the speed of light, then it actually has a world length which goes at 45 degree angle. So.
Do you want to try the cloth with some
erasing?
Yeah,
sure.
Okay. We'll just keep, yeah, we'll keep depleting the boards until we run out, and so if we have, thanks, so if we have light going from here to here, if we have something that travels from here to here where the angle is 45 degrees, so for every 1 unit out, it goes 1 unit up, then let's calculate the speed of it. So the speed of it is just the distance divided by time. That's fine. So here we have 1 unit up, 1 unit out, and so the time is one there, and the distance is one, and so I'm left just with speed here, c, and so this actually has speed of one there. Sorry, speed of c. So that's the reason for that, with the time and the space, just cancel out. We'll just let c, which gives us the speed for that. So what we have is, then we'll just go back. So So we've got the time axis up here for CT dash axis. So that's the time axis for Klingon in spaceship. So we've got that. We're happy with that. And so we've got time somehow on there. And so that's zero time there. And this might be the time minus T down here. And this is the time plus capital T up there. Now, all of these points, these correspond to the world line of the Klingon spaceship. So basically, by following this line, you track the path following all the points that it goes. So at some point back here, it actually meets some light, and it travels off, in some direction. But we know the angle of it has to be 45 degrees, because in the Earth reference frame, the person on Earth, they'll see the light traveling at 45 degrees. So then when they measure that, and actually plot its path in a space-time diagram, that's 45 degrees. So light always travels at a 45-degree angle. So Lethea is on some sort of path at a 45-degree angle, but somehow it has to end up back here, because we know the light bounces out to the mirror where the mirror is, and then comes back to the spaceship. And so this is the point where the spaceship receives the light after it's come back. And so the light has some event, the pulse of it traveling out or the front of it, and then coming back. And so what we should be able to do is draw a broad line for the light, or it could even be a single photon as it bounces out and it goes back. So basically we should be able to create a little picture of the single photon to make it easiest if you imagine just one photon, or actually just a small clump of photons altogether localized. We should be able to plot kind of their trajectory, if you like, in space and time, on a space-time diagram, just like we did for all the other examples we did for the 100-meter runner in the Olympic race. And so what it will look like is, well, actually one of these four options. So assuming that the light travels off in the positive x direction, that's the assumption that we have, so it travels off in the positive x direction, starts at A, ends back at C, and so the question is, which of those four options will it be? So what I'll give you a couple of minutes to discuss those around you, and come up with the answer, what you think the path of the world line of light will be, and also, again, think about what misconceptions might be embodied in three answers that you think are wrong. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, guys. There's lots of conversation going on, but you're going to have to watch for a big event. He had to rush out, so all of a sudden he realized he may have told the researchers a bunch at 1 o'clock. But he's just going to go try and panic and see if he can find some researchers. So we're going to go through. So let's see your answers. All right. Beautiful. Okay, so everybody realized that Damien told you the answer before the question.
That's big picture.
Okay, but just to clarify, the Earth is the Earth. So why couldn't it be C, for example?
Like those
in travel. It's not even 25 degree angle.
Yeah, right. Okay, so on when we're talking about light always has to be traveling, has to appear at a 45 degree angle on your
even so from that, doesn't that say it's moving without time? Okay, it did a whole bunch of
right.
Work. Yeah.
So we
don't need that. And same for this one, right?
Okay.
What about A?
Negative.
It's going backwards on the
other side.
System.
So what does that mean, though? It's going backwards.
That it would be getting closer to the map being extended.
It's fine to send the light backwards. But when it hits B, it has to go at 45 degrees to get back to the Klingon, and it won't happen at C.
The instruction here is the light is drawn in the object.
Yeah.
So here, that's what in the negative.
Yeah.
So it just means the mirror is behind you. So this is perfectly valid. For a different wire.
But it's also perfectly valid for finding the x-prime axis if it's drawn correctly. It's not drawn correctly because the line BC in A is not at 45 degrees.
Why not?
Well, just because it's not.
It's just not drawn correctly.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't his right answer here, he wasn't as careful to make sure that that's the right angle. He just didn't draw it carefully.
Also, the length from the origin of C and the length from the origin of A are not the same length.
Your AB is
different.
Yeah. How many people, just curious, to teach special ed, how many of you actually use these to teaching special ed too? Yeah.
An extension of the very
okay, this is one of the ideas that we're trying to explore here in terms of one thing we've noticed with special relativity and the way we teach it, it tends to become just, here's the formulas, throw numbers in, crunch it. And that's really, that's a huge disservice to special relativity. So one of the things we're trying to probe is, would this give us more of a conceptual understanding rather than an algebraic one?
Oh yeah, I think so.
As some of you know, I don't actually teach physics, but I dusted off a relativity book from university days last night. Special relativity, and I was looking at it, and the Lorentz contraction, the mathematical derivation of it, was covered in this book, which is like second year university, and it's the same kind of stuff that's being taught here, except it's accompanied with the actual mathematics that leads to the famous square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared. And I found that when I was reading this last night, despite the noise of the people right below me, that it was actually easier to understand because of the accompanying mathematics than, for example, this discussion is. So I'm just wondering, does anybody who teaches special relativity to high school students, senior high school students, do you ever actually derive the Lorentz contraction?
Well, we already did derive the Lorentz contraction.
Yeah,
that light here, that S equals B squared, that is the Lorentz contraction, just written in a different way. That's already, when you end up in Lorentz space, you've done the Lorentz contraction.
there's no square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared.
It's just rearranging the equation to get the contraction. And the Lorentz contraction was there before Einstein could harness relativity. You can actually, this is another thing to understand, you can actually come up with a different explanation for Lorentz contraction than Einstein did. There was a competing theory at the time of Einstein that worked, but it was based on his physical principles.
If we hadn't assumed that the light had to travel in the clockwise direction, if we were okay with it traveling in the direction. Now, it's leaving A that has to leave at a 45 degree angle, so is it A or D that are closer to the correct answer if light could travel in the opposite direction?
Well, light can be A. This is valid, this one here. If we were talking about shining light factors, this is exactly what the line would look like right there, going from A to B. Where this diagram that later seems to be done here, where this diagram is a little bit of a problem, is going this way, and that's the wrong angle. That should get 45, so it'll be a little steeper. Okay?
Yep. Just the amount of B, C in mind B. Okay, in picture B, you can never have a horizontal line.
Yeah. Horizontal lines on your space-time diagrams are meaningless. Guys, there's a number of things you can do with these world bonds and these space-time diagrams. They're incredibly powerful. I think it was last year we had a presentation. One of the researchers just basically started with these world diagrams, and you ended up with black holes and all the laws defining black holes just from a space-time diagram. It was phenomenal. And they're very, very powerful. And that's one of the things that, and because it moves us away from the algebra, we're trying to explore this. And this is one of the things we're going to be asking you to do, is go back to your classes and give this a bit of a try and explore it a little bit.
Did he leave a set of notes on that presentation?
I could probably find them somewhere. I have stacks of notes that are unorganized completely. I'll look for what I'm following.
So you're saying leaving the algebra behind can help make it clear for students that may might struggle with the math? Or
yes.
Or my question, which is bringing the algebra in, can actually make it clearer as well in a certain way.
Okay, this is something where we start with the teachers. We find algebra clarifies things. It doesn't necessarily for students. And also, the algebra, what tends to happen then is special relativity becomes all about just getting the answer from the equation. And that's not what we're after. We're after trying to get to understand how our universe works. And this gives us a bit more of a picture. And sometimes moving away from the math actually allows us to understand concepts better. And it becomes less answer-oriented.
Why label these axes CT?
The CT stuff, puts perspective to this. That gives you the 45-degree angle. If that was just T, then you would have, everything would be like that. Your scale is off. So you really have to move in. This is something theoretical physicists do a lot, is they set their world where C equals 1 and G equals 1 and everything is 1 and then everything is very simple.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting lesson to teach your students about unit analysis. One of the things I talked to them about is one of the researchers a couple of years ago said, you know what, all I've worked with are the fundamental units. I just take G and C and H, and I play with them.
Yeah.
And I say, what if I combine them in different orders, what units do I get?
Yeah.
And then I get something cool to learn if I study.
Yeah.
And that's actually what drives his research, is that just looking at the units. And that's one of the things he's doing here.
Yeah. So the big thing is the C here is not the unit, it's just a constant. It's just a scale. It's just a
scale factor.
It's a scale factor.
The way this is presented here, I think it's quite difficult to try to teach this. I'm struggling to understand this myself, and without a good amount of explanation that I can read and digest myself.
Yeah.
I would probably confuse the kid at the same time I'm confusing myself. And furthermore, most textbooks at this point, I think, do not approach it this way, but approach it with a traditional Lorentz transformation equation, the algebra. So if we want to approach it this way, we need a lot of supporting material.
That's what we're about here.
Plus, a lot of syllabus out there right now aren't the traditional approach. I'm referring to textbooks, but syllabus as in
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. So a couple of things about one thing. Definitely at this stage, this will be very challenging to teach to your students. And this is more why this, what we're hoping largely with this enrichment presentation, at least in the short term, is this sort of stuff that you teachers can get to give you a deeper understanding. Hopefully as we go through them and get to play around them some more, by the end of tomorrow, you know, it's everyone feels more comfortable. With them, because you can get this really beautiful, basically, pictorial, I keep saying, basically, you can read off, you can see from a graph why the twin paradox happens. So that's where we're leading to. This is a way, basically, a lot of, so one level above, I guess, a lot of times, Christian University courses, they teach this liberal arts colleges in the US. And it does, I mean, it is, there are some subtle concepts, you're right, but there is advantage, it doesn't really involve mathematics. So one thing we are looking at, I haven't mentioned this, but we're actually looking to get together, we would like to get together development teams to actually develop some of the things that we're talking about, like the LED lab, and like something I'm going to present, and actually get teachers that are prepared, that actually will try them out, and then give us feedback, because we know this will sort of take some time and some tweaking. So this is actually something I'll talk more about tomorrow, and how the GPS actually uses the time dilation and formula in relativity, that we really are sort of working towards getting resources on our webpage that teachers around the world can use. But I would say, so maybe this is very very optimistic, but in the long term, I mean, you go back 20, 30 years ago, there were people that were saying, oh, you could never teach computers to kids in high school, they're just too complicated. They're just too difficult, and it's only getting a university degree and so forth. But that's obviously changed a lot. And so maybe, I think, you know, this would need a lot of work. No one is really doing this at the high school, to be honest. No, maybe there's one or two teachers around the world that do it at the high school level. But I think if you worked on this, maybe.
We at least want to try it. One of the things that's motivating us here is that we look at the physics textbooks that are out there. In Ontario, we just got all new textbooks. And especially for quantum mechanics, they're brutal. Like, core concept, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, not even mentioned in one of the textbooks. In the other textbook, it's mentioned almost historically, oh, there's this guy named Heisenberg here. But they all do black body, they all do photoelectric. And meanwhile, the guys in this building all say, well, who cares about those concepts? They're not actually important. And yet the textbooks are all full of them because that's what we've always done. So one of the things we're trying to do here is challenge that. Listen to the researchers, right? What's really important? What are the key concepts? And then part of our job is to translate it down into a classroom so that we can give them the richest understanding. And yeah, it is going to, we do have to produce the resources because they're not there.
Yeah. So what we want to do, I mean, I plan on being around here. I mean, we want to work with teachers. So obviously there are a lot of things we need to improve. So please tell us what we need to do. At the moment, we're just focusing on modern physics because that obviously is our strength, which is, and we, you know, we realize that's just this one part, one small fraction of what you teach. But it's a very important area. But I take your point that, it's difficult. Right. Okay.
I would suggest with my experience, different students learn differently, and there are some very strongly understand the graphic way of seeing things, some others are very algebraic, and I would say that until we have very well developed. Both approaches. I would be supposed to grow both.
Absolutely.
I always find that 40% are better from the graphic model
Yep.
Others understand vectors better.
Yep.
Others understand graphs better.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that people, I mean, a lot of research has shown people have different learning styles. And that's why, absolutely, it's always good to have explained something one way, then another way. And you pick up different fractions and different students. So, absolutely.
And I think it complements each other, too. I try very much to teach the translation from one to the other.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. That's very good. Yes.
Okay. Now, this was pre-caffeine, so I'm sorry. But the concept, the lifetime, I realized after it was pointed out to me that you actually have a distance. Your vertical axis is a distance graph. Your CT really is a distance graph.
Yeah.
Now, can you just arbitrarily change it? Because you said the space-time graph had time on the vertical axis, so I was thinking that had to be just a multiplier, but according to the notes, that is in meters.
Yeah,
like CP is really in meters. So can you just do that on a space-time graph, make it now meters and meters
rather than
meters?
Because that's skill.
So in some sense you can. So I mean a lot of them just have. So Dave talked before about physicists just setting C equal to 1, and that's so-called natural units, and they do that. And you might think, well, it's 1. What are the units there? It's actually 1. So you can in the following sense that, I mean, Newtonian physics, according to Newton, time and space are very different things. And they seem like very different things. Space is something you measure with a meter stick, with a tape measure, and time is something that ticks away. But in special relativity, again, there's no fundamental distinction between space and time. What I see as space, someone else moving at a really, really, really high velocity with respect to the speed of light, or moving, you know, at a very, very high speed, we'll see as a mixture of space and time. So what is space is not absolute, and what is time is not absolute. They actually get mixed up. And so there's no fundamental distinction between the two. And so in that sense, you know, physicists could say, well, you know, we can just use... Sometimes you see a lot of books just have time. There.
I guess the reason for this is because if I was to try to do something like this with students, if I just all of a sudden magically change time into distance, they're gone. They're gone. You say, how can you do that? They're not the same thing. I can give them an argument and say, well, really, they are.
Yeah.
But they're going to go, forget it, I'm out of here.
Well, so, okay, then all you do is you leave it as time, and then your scale is in years instead of
time. If I say that C is a multiplier, and that's all this is a scale factor, don't worry about it. My kids can handle that.
Absolutely, you can do that. Okay, so let's just make it C, which is just...
It's just a multiplier.
It's just that, and there's no
use. That's not going to be wrong. I'm not going to have some physicists on high whack in my class.
No, not at all. No.
Okay.
No, that's the
other option you have is make your units, your vertical units for times in years, your horizontal unit in x is light years. That's your ultimate.
Like
and then everything's 45 degrees, and it's all.
Oh, and that's perfect. Just one second.
That's
all.
That's exactly what they're doing here. It's essentially the same
thing.
Yeah.
Except for in that case, I'm not changing.
Right.
I'm not changing into a fundamentally different measurement from their point of view.
Yeah.
But perhaps the best thing to do at this level is to say we're years later.
Okay. Okay. So we've had a lot of time to think over that. So maybe could everyone write down their whiteboards?
Okay.
And everyone got D, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's playing on, so they teleported.
Okay. So as you can see, so the word lines for light, it's a fantastic answer. B, it's always to the right. And that makes this gradient of 1, and you get the speed of light being C there, because if you have x equals 1, CT equals 1, then that means time equals 1 over C. So if you plug that into x over t, you get 1 divided by 1 over C, which gives you C. And that's why 45 degrees corresponds, it means the speed of light. We have CT equals 1 and x equals 1. Great. So that's the event there, B. That's the light photon hitting the mirror and bouncing back. But we know that from the Klingon's perspective, from the perspective of the spaceship, what that did is that happened at time zero. Because at time minus T, the light got sent out, and then came back plus T. Difference between those is 2T. And so the event, the middle event, must be time zero. Minus T, zero, plus T. But we found out we've located where that event is on the space-time diagram. It happens to be there. And so we know that's an event. That's an event on the that corresponds to T dash equals zero. But so that's an event on the x-axis, because remember the x-dash axis defined by all these series of points that have time equals zero. Exactly as if we wanted to find, we could find the x-axis or derive it by just finding all the points where time is equal to zero here for the Earth observer. Find those, just join, draw a line through them. That's the x-dash x-axis for the person on Earth. We're going to be doing exactly the same thing for the Klingon, for the person in the spaceship. And so we found at least one of those points, B, on that axis, the x-dash axis. So we set the light at a time minus T. We didn't have to send it that time. We could have sent it at a slightly earlier time here. That would have taken a bit longer to get to there, and then a slightly longer time to bounce back. And if we did that, what we would do is we would see, again, we would have a 45-degree line, because light always travels at a 45-degree angle in space-time diagrams, except it would just start a little bit further back. It would go up here and then bounce back. But again, this point here is where it hits the mirror, and if we place the mirror where it would hit the mirror, we have to have the mirror at a different location, but we could have another mirror. It hits the mirror here and bounces back, just by the same argument as before, where it hits the mirror. So it might, for example, leave at minus 2 times t, hit the mirror at time 0, and then bounce back and arrive back at plus 2 times t. So again, this point here, which is analogous to B, I guess it's kind of not quite in there, but that is the point t dash equals 0 that the Klingon will see as... Yep.
Yeah, it's awkward drawing in PowerPoint. So if your three points are looking almost horizontal,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's right. That's a little bit.
It's hard drawing.
We really want to.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. So. Okay. And so we can do that again for just a beam of light, Klingon sending the light at time minus 3 capital T. So what we do is basically just at earlier and earlier times, so we could have the whole series of laser beams. It's the Klingon commander or the spaceship commander is just turning it on earlier and earlier times, like goes to different mirrors and bounces back. And if we look at the positions of all those mirrors when the light photons hit them, they are all points that the Klingon perceives from his or her reference frame are exactly time t equals zero. So we have this whole series of points here, here, and here. And, well, they actually should be in a straight line. And then going, obviously, through the orange as well. So if we draw...
Oh, perfect fit. Yeah.
Something like that. So if we sort of join them up, exactly an analogy to kind of joining up all these points to get the x-axis, to get that axis here, we join them up. So I think if you go up to the next page, you actually have... A sheet without the x-axis on. So if you could draw that on and then compare your answer to the person next to you and see if you agree. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah, you can do that. But I, yeah. Yeah, you can do that. I guess I was thinking, like, a priority is going to be if you assume it's a straight line. Yeah, but that's the point. Maybe that's the simple way. Because it's going to be a straight line, or whatever it is.
It's hard to get to the same
time. It is, yeah. Yeah. So maybe, yeah, it's easier to just put 2 points and just. Right, done is really derive the transformation of what two different coordinate systems look like. So again, going back to forgetting about special relativity, going back to Galilean relativity or Newtonian mechanics, this is what we have. It's the axes are right angles to each other. There's just the reference frame, some moving at a constant velocity with respect to some initial reference frame. Intuitively, the axis just moves along at this constant rate like this. But special relativity, it's kind of strange, but you actually get the axes not, they're not at right angles to each other. So there's actually less than 90 degrees between them. And if you look at the slopes of them, well, this slope here is the speed of the object. It's actually the, so at 45 degrees, it's going at a speed of c. Any speed above, or any slope above 45 degrees, greater than 1, you have velocity less than c. And so the actual slope of that is actually a measure of, it's really related to the velocity. And the slope of CT dash axis actually does, if you look at it, has a slope of C divided by V. So it always has a slope greater than 1, and it's greater than 1 just by the ratio of the speed of light relative to the velocity. And you can actually, I mean, you can see that just by, because you can plot all these events, look at all these events from the reference frame of someone in Earth, and if you actually, actually if you do that, you should be able to get, you have this gradient here. If you want to find out what the gradient is, the gradient is just CT, I guess delta CT divided by delta X, and but in a time t, it will move, okay, a distance. Which ends that issue. The gradient is going to y over x, so it's c delta t divided by delta x. And that's and the delta t's cancel out, and you get c over b, so that's how you get the slope of that. And if you actually look at the x-axis, that's actually a reflection about the 45-degree axis over here. So that has the reflection about it, so it has the inverse slope of that. So so the slope, if you actually measure the slope of the x-axis, that x-dash axis, that's actually b over c, and you can get our a similar argument to that. So what we actually have now is, so essentially we have this idea of space-time diagrams. You can sort of put all these events, all these happenings on them. We have some sequence of events, a car driving on a road or whatever. Then we can actually get a world line for the space-time diagram and actually plot that. And we want to know, look at things from different reference frames or different perspectives. And so we need some kind of way of transforming from different reference frames. And we need to have alternative reference frames. We have that. We've got a reference frame for someone traveling at the speed of half the speed of light. And generally what happens is that as you actually increase your speed faster and faster, if you look at the t-dash and x-dash axes, then they start being like this, and they gradually go like that, and then closer and closer. And eventually, if you're actually traveling at the speed of light, then the x and your time and your space axes actually coincide with each other. And so in some sense, the time and space actually really do sort of lose their individual meaning. And that's why one thing, something very, very strange, actually the light of a photon would be very strange if the time and the space axes coincide. Yep?
Just, you know, the way you put it in terms of slope and all that, I'm going to go and play with this when I get home, but I'm just thinking, well, why don't you relate it to, like, tan of theta or something?
Right.
Because that might be, especially when you've got the slopes to other axes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's any merit in using that as a device, teaching device. I'm just going to play with it. I don't know if that's something.
Yeah.
Is your slope, is your gradient.
Okay.
So there might be some way of, I'm going to play with it anyway.
Yeah, okay. So getting the angle in there, because kids know about trigonometric functions and relating it back to stuff they've heard before.
Yeah.
So definitely there could be, and that angle, I mean, that angle gives you information about the velocity.
Well, it's going to give you C over B.
Yeah.
The angle's got an inverse tan, it's going to give you C over B, so don't know, it's just something we're just
yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I mean, some books definitely do have that in the angle. It's, yeah, very useful. So, yeah, that's another way of looking at it. It could be very useful. So thank you for that. So, essentially what you have, different coordinate transformations. And so the only thing we don't have, we'll actually look at this tomorrow, the only thing we don't have actually is a scale on these axes. So we have basically the graduations, the x equals 1, x, 2 equals 3, time equals 1, 2, 3 there. So that's the only thing we don't have, and we might actually leave that for tomorrow. And we just put the scale on then, and once we put the scale, we can actually plot events happening such as the light in a light clock. Look back at the light clock here. And we see that the light bouncing back and forth, the photon bouncing back and forth. And so, well, actually, that's more, actually, we'll maybe not use that example. That's actually, that you need, there's two dimensions there, so you need a three-dimensional space-time diagram for that. But another example, again, just looking at, so the standard example, looking at someone in a spaceship traveling at 3/4 of the speed of light, how we see their time as being evolved and what rate that progresses at. Their time gets stretched out or dilated or expanded to us, and you can actually see that graphically on a space-time diagram. And again, without actually even using or knowing the space time dilation formula, you can actually find out, basically in a sense, that it is measure and read off the graph time dilation once you actually have the graphs in place. Yes?
Before I go to lunch, because I think a lot of people send those, but they're thinking, can I do this?
Yeah.
You might want to mention that fabulous author you mentioned to me. Because if they...
What was it?
Thomas More.
We're going to mention that in the character.
Is that okay? Fine. Okay, cool.
Right.
I put it on the list.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I'll mention that now. So a lot of the notes we got from... There's a book called... Six Ideas to Change Physics?
Yeah.
Is it?
His earlier one, that Traveler's Guide to Space Time, is also good. But
is that the whole series? Is that a series?
Yeah.
That's, yes,
the
series
books.
Is the back.
And for this one, you want book R for relativity.
So this person is teaches at university level in the US and California. And he really has been working on explaining or teaching space-time diagrams for about a decade to his students. So it's a liberal arts college. And so a lot of what I've done in these notes here are based on his book. So he has a book that's, I think it's one, the R one.
R.
Yep. And it's fantastic book. So he really has been thinking for a long time about this, about the clearest ways to explain things for his students. And so I think that's a really, really good book. I think it's fantastic. Okay. So what we might do just before we go to lunch, we'll just switch back to... So tomorrow what we'll do is we'll really build upon the space-time diagrams, and we'll actually look and get the axes on the time on the space and time axes for the alternate frames. And then what we'll actually do is see time dilation, see length contraction coming out of those, and finish off with the Flynn paradox. But what I'll do is I'll just return to... So I'll talk a bit about this more tomorrow, but just to finish up. So in a sense, you can actually see time dilation and length contraction in what we're looking at now. But with the roller coaster ride, someone said they wanted me to go through text. So there's actually a lot of things here. So there's one thing, the big thing, basically, you actually see these lines here, these horizontal supports. They're horizontal when you're not moving. They're just a straight line. But when you actually get into it, they're kind of curved and actually bent around like bananas. And the reason, and if you look also at these vertical poles here, basically all these objects that should or actually are straight and appear to be straight when you're actually going at almost the speed of light, they're all curved and they're warped. So the question is, why does that happen? The reason that's happening is basically we're actually seeing different, because we're traveling kind of close to the speed that light travels, And we see something because light hits the object, reflects it off, and comes into our eyes. We're actually seeing different parts of the objects at different times. And so if we see light sort of hits the middle of this support here, this horizontal rail, and bounces off into our eyes, so imagine we're right in front of it here, then it will take, you know, some time to get from there to there. There's a little delay. We don't see the object actually as it is, but what it as a split second earlier in time. So, I mean, as you're looking at me now, you're not actually seeing me as I am. You're seeing me as I was probably a couple of nanoseconds or tens of nanoseconds earlier. That'll be about 90 nanoseconds earlier in time, just because the light has to get from here, reflect off me, and then go into your eyes. So there's some delay. In ordinary life, it's insignificant. It doesn't matter. Our brain can't even process time or anything in the order of nanoseconds, so we don't see that. But if we're traveling close to the speed of light, then we're getting in the same sort of speeds at which this information travels through us, then it matters. And so light from the edges here actually has to travel, if we're right in the middle here, instead of having to travel down this straight path here, has to travel down a diagonal path. So it has to go from there like that. So that's obviously a longer distance. And so as a result, what that means is it takes a little bit more time to do that. And so there's a bit more of a delay in actually seeing the edges in the middle. And so because there's more of a delay, we actually see the edges as they were as a tiny bit earlier in time, rather than a tiny bit later. So we see the edges as they were at a slightly earlier moment in time and in the middle at a slightly later moment in time. And now, if the thing is moving towards us, or we're actually rushing towards the railing at close to the speed of light, then where was it at an earlier time? Well, we're getting closer and closer to it, so in an earlier time it was further and further away. And so it was further and further away. We actually, basically, yeah, further and further away. So we see the edges as further away from us, the middle is closer, and that's what gives us kind of this sort of bendy shape like that. And if you do similar sort of reasoning, you can get a bend shape for this. And if you actually look at the horizon is not flat, but it's sort of curved around, and it's exactly the same type of reasoning. Due to the fact that the finite speed of light really matters and significant when you're up near the same ballpark as the speed of light. So you see a lot of those effects in one. The other one is, it's kind of complicated, but you see Doppler shift. And qualitatively, it's the same exactly as the classical Doppler shift, although the details of the relativistic Doppler shift it changes quantitatively, just the frequencies. But the effect is the same. We're going towards things still do get blue shifted. Yes?
I noticed through the video they stopped with the Doppler shift halfway through. And that's just because they got finished with it, or did something change?
No, so that's just a technical thing, because I think the scale on which that occurs is slightly different to the scale on which the bending occurs. So they actually sort of turned it on and off, just technical reasons to nothing. Yeah, fundamental.
And we decided to turn it off.
But so what actually happens, all the visible light gets shifted to UV, so you don't see that, but all the infrared gets shifted to visible, so you see infrared. So when it actually goes gray, what I think they actually had to make some assumptions about what the infrared spectrum was, and that actually they assumed that it was actually just sort of constant spectrum, and so that's basically constant light. Gives you the infrared, gives you the gray, so that's where they get the gray from. But I think they are turning it on and off at various points. So there, I think the two main things are the Doppler shift and finite. Yes, Bill.
What you were saying about space or the shapes earlier, does that imply that something that's semicircular, an object that's semicircular while we're standing still, will be invariant as you move closer to the speed of light?
So it's interesting. There's actually one shape and only one shape that actually appears that maintains its shape as you're moving towards it in the speed of light, and that's a sphere. So in that sense, yeah, it does. So, yeah, every other shape gets distorted. So, we'll show that again. And essentially, all the text down the bottom is that's what it's saying. So,
can you read the text in the bottom?
Okay. The relativistic roller coaster, we imagine either that the speed of light is very slow or that the objects are very big. So we can. Sorry?
Yeah.
Okay. The Doppler effect is turned on, infrared light is shifted into the visible spectrum. Distortions occur as space and time become mixed, seeing different parts at different moments in time. We see more distant things by older light, hence the object's parts may be seen at different times. The ends of lines are further away because light came from them when they were further away, based on what I was explaining before. The overall effect is a curving of lines, including the horizon. Okay, and that's it. So I'll show. Again, there are about 10 more of those, and I'll show some probably tomorrow. But yeah, these basically really see. And we'll see how they actually relate to time dilation and length contraction. But now, time for lunch. Yes.